A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's one of those things where once you see it, you can't unsee it. Walk into any new high-rise in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem, and there they are, little sprinkler heads dotting the ceiling. Walk into a building from the 1970s, and there's nothing. Just a smoke detector that may or may not have batteries. So Daniel's asking two things. First, are these sprinklers a lesson written in disaster? Did we only start putting them in because enough people died? And second, is this specifically a high-rise problem, where the physics of a tall building makes individual fire extinguishers almost pointless? And then there's the retrofit elephant in the room, thousands of older buildings with none of this. Let's get into it.
The visual contrast tells the story before you even ask the question. That gap between the new tower and the old apartment block is the gap between two completely different regulatory eras, and the line between them is drawn in specific fires with specific death tolls. I want to start with what we're actually talking about when we say fire suppression system, because there's a lot of movie nonsense floating around.
The one where pulling one fire alarm sets off every sprinkler in the building and everyone gets drenched.
What we're talking about is an automatic fire sprinkler system. A network of pipes with individual sprinkler heads spaced every few meters. Each head has a little glass bulb filled with a glycerin-based liquid. When the temperature at the ceiling hits about 68 degrees Celsius, roughly 155 Fahrenheit, the liquid expands, the glass shatters, and a plug drops out. Water flows from that one head and only that one head. In a typical residential fire, one or two sprinklers activate, not the whole floor, not the whole building.
The movie scene where someone holds a lighter to one sprinkler and the entire office floods is just Hollywood plumbing.
Hollywood plumbing is a great phrase, and it matters because that misconception makes people afraid of sprinklers. They think a burnt piece of toast means their apartment gets destroyed. The reality is that a sprinkler releases about 25 gallons of water per minute. A firefighter's hose runs at about 150 gallons per minute. You'd much rather have the sprinkler water damage than the fire department hose damage, never mind the fire damage.
That's the technology. How far back does this go?
The first modern sprinkler was patented in 1872 by Philip Pratt, mostly for factories and warehouses. Residential adoption took more than a century to really take hold, and that's where your disaster question comes in. The big turning points are surprisingly recent. The 1980 MGM Grand Fire in Las Vegas, 85 dead. The 1986 DuPont Plaza Hotel Fire in San Juan, 97 dead. Those two fires specifically drove hotel sprinkler mandates in the United States. But for residential buildings, the real accelerant was Grenfell Tower in 2017.
Grenfell is the one where the exterior cladding caught fire.
72 people died, and the building had no sprinklers. It was a cladding fire. The exterior panels acted like a chimney, but the absence of internal suppression meant there was nothing to slow the spread once it breached the interior. The UK's response was the Building Safety Act of 2022, which now mandates sprinklers in all new residential buildings over 11 meters. That's about 3 or 4 stories. Grenfell is the single clearest example of a disaster directly producing a code change, and it happened less than a decade ago.
We had our own version of that chain.
Israel's Fire Safety Standard, Sebluation of Calls, SI 1220, was first adopted in 1991, but it was pretty minimal for residential buildings. What changed things here were two events. The 2010 Carmel Forest Fire killed 44 people, mostly prison service trainees on a bus, and that exposed how under-resourced the entire fire service was. But the specific residential wake-up call was the 2014 fire on Ben Yehuda Street in Tel Aviv. 7-story building, no sprinklers, fire spread through the stairwell, 6 people dead including a firefighter. That directly led to Amendment 5 of SI 1220 in 2015, which requires sprinklers in all new residential buildings over 29 meters, about 10 stories.
That number, 29 meters, is not random.
Not at all. It's the ladder limit. A standard aerial fire ladder reaches about 30 meters. Above that, the fire department cannot rescue you from the outside. You are entirely dependent on internal suppression and protected stairwells. The physics here is called the stack effect. Hot gases rise through stairwells and elevator shafts, creating a natural chimney. In a tall building, the stairwell itself becomes a flue. If the fire is below you and the stairwell is open, you cannot go down, and the ladder can't reach you. Sprinklers are the only thing that buys you time, typically 5 to 10 extra minutes, by suppressing the fire at its source before it reaches the stairwell.
The 29-meter threshold is basically the point where the fire department waves and says, "Good luck, you're on your own."
That's the blunt way to put it, but yes. Which brings us to the retrofit question Daniel raised, because there are thousands of buildings in Israel built before 2015 that sit above that height with no sprinklers. And the barriers to fixing that are not really technical, they're economic and social.
What does it actually cost to retrofit a building?
For a typical 10-story residential building in Israel, you're looking at 1.5 to 3 million shekels, roughly $400,000 to $800,000 US. That's pipes through every ceiling, a new water supply riser, often a pump system because municipal water pressure isn't enough for upper floors. And here's the kicker. You need access to every apartment. Walls get opened, ceilings come down, residents have to vacate for days or weeks. Now layer on the Israeli ownership structure. Most apartment buildings are governed by a house committee, a Va'ad Bayit. Major expenses require a majority vote of owners. You're asking each apartment owner to chip in maybe 50,000 shekels for something they might never need, in a building where half the residents are renters and the owners don't even live there.
The Va'ad Bayit becomes the place where fire safety goes to die.
And it's not just Israel. This is the retrofit problem everywhere. But Israel has a specific additional tension. The country has been building taller and taller. We now have residential towers over 80 stories. The building stock is stratifying into two tiers, the sprinklered new builds and the unprotected older stock, and the older stock isn't going anywhere.
At some point, insurance companies start noticing the gap.
They already have. In Israel, property insurance for buildings without sprinklers runs 20 to 40% higher. Some insurers now require sprinkler retrofits for buildings over 10 stories as a condition of coverage. That's creating a market-driven retrofit incentive where regulation has failed. If your building insurance doubles, suddenly that 50,000 shekel assessment looks different.
The invisible hand of the insurance market might succeed where the Va'ad Bayit fails.
That's the theory. Japan takes a different approach. They require sprinklers in all new residential buildings over 6 stories, about 20 meters. Germany draws the line at 22 meters. The U.S. varies by state, but the National Fire Protection Standard, NFPA 101, requires sprinklers in all new high-rise residential. There's no scientific consensus on the exact height threshold. It's a policy choice. Israel chose 29 meters because that's where the ladder stops. Japan chose 20 meters, which is more conservative. Neither is wrong. They're just betting differently on how much risk they're willing to grandfather into the existing building stock.
The short answer to Daniel's first question is yes. Sprinklers are absolutely a lesson from disaster. The specific fires have names, dates, and death tolls, and the code changes followed them like clockwork. And to his second question, the height threshold is the ladder limit. Above 10 stories, internal suppression is not a luxury. It's the only option. The retrofit question is where it gets messy, because the problem isn't that we don't know how to install sprinklers in old buildings. It's that nobody wants to pay for it. And the governance structure of apartment ownership makes collective action nearly impossible until something terrible happens.
Which is the grim logic of fire safety regulation in general. The code gets written after the fire. The question Daniel's really asking is whether we can break that pattern and retrofit before the next Ben Yehuda Street rather than after. That pattern is worth sitting with for a moment, because the gap between when the technology exists and when we actually require it is surprisingly wide. Philip Pratt patents the sprinkler in 1872. It puts out fires. And for more than 100 years, we mostly don't require it in the places people sleep.
Which is a strange kind of inertia when you think about it. The thing exists, it's proven, and we just sort of shrug and say maybe later.
The MGM Grand Fire in 1980 is the one that really cracked that open for hotels. 85 dead, most from smoke inhalation on the upper floors. The building had no sprinklers. The fire started in a ground floor restaurant and smoke traveled up through seismic joints and elevator shafts. Classic stack effect. After that, Clark County and then the rest of the U.S. started requiring sprinklers in hotels. But notice the pattern. It took a specific, highly visible disaster with a large death toll to move the needle. The DuPont Plaza fire 6 years later, 97 dead, same dynamic. Arson in a ground floor ballroom, no sprinklers, smoke up the stairwells.
Even then, those were commercial spaces. Hotels, casinos, assembly halls. Nobody was talking about your apartment building.
Residential was the last frontier. And in Israel, the timeline is even more compressed. The country's first comprehensive fire safety standard, SI 1220, didn't arrive until 1991, a full century after Pratt's patent. And even then, it was mostly focused on commercial and industrial buildings. Residential requirements were minimal. It took the Carmel fire in 2010 to shock the system into recognizing how underprepared the country was. But even that was a wildfire. The residential building fire on Ben Yehuda Street in 2014 was the one that made people look up at their own ceilings. 6 dead in a 7-story building with no sprinklers, fire spreading through an unprotected stairwell. A firefighter died in that one.
That's the one that produced the actual code change.
Amendment. 5 to SI 1220, 2015. Sprinklers required in all new residential buildings over 29 meters, the exact ladder limit. The fire department can't reach you above that, so the building has to protect itself.
The short history is, the technology existed for over a century, but the political will to mandate it only arrived after specific disasters with names and body counts. And in Israel, that happened less than a decade ago. Which means every building older than that is living in the regulatory past.
The pattern is so consistent, it's almost a law of regulatory physics. The 1911 Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire in New York, 146 dead, mostly young immigrant women, because the exit doors were locked to prevent breaks. That one drove exit requirements and fire drills. The 1942 Coconut Grove nightclub fire in Boston, 492 dead in a single building. The main exit was a single revolving door. After that, sprinklers became mandatory in assembly spaces.
492. That's a small town.
The thing is, the Coconut Grove had no sprinklers. The fire spread through flammable decorations on the ceiling. People were trapped at the revolving door, bodies piled up. After that, Boston and then the rest of the country rewrote the rules. Then fast forward to 2003, the Station nightclub fire in Rhode Island. 100 dead. Pyrotechnics during a band's opening song ignited soundproofing foam on the walls. The building had no sprinklers. That one drove stricter occupancy limits and mandatory sprinklers for assembly spaces nationwide.
The sequence is grim but predictable. A fire happens, a lot of people die, an investigation reveals something that should have been obvious, and the code gets patched. Then we wait for the next one.
The patch is always specific to the thing that just killed people. Exit doors after Triangle, revolving doors after Coconut Grove, pyrotechnics, and foam after the station. Nobody was connecting the dots to say maybe we should just put sprinklers everywhere people gather or sleep. Grenfell is the one where that finally happened for residential.
Grenfell is interesting because it wasn't a sprinkler failure. It was a cladding failure. The exterior panels were basically solid rocket fuel, and the building had no internal suppression at all.
The aluminum composite panels had a polyethylene core, banned in several countries before Grenfell, but the UK hadn't acted. The fire started in a 4th-floor apartment, a refrigerator malfunction, and it spread out the window to the cladding. Within minutes, the entire exterior was burning. But here's the thing. If the building had sprinklers, the fire might never have reached the cladding. The initial apartment fire would have been suppressed at the source. The UK's Building Safety Act of 2022 drew exactly that conclusion. Sprinklers in all new residential buildings over 11 meters. That's 3 or 4 stories. It's the most aggressive threshold anywhere.
11 meters is a lot lower than Israel's 29.
It's a direct response to the trauma. Grenfell was a 24-story building, but the UK didn't say 24 stories. They said 11 meters. They drew the line low enough to catch almost everything. Israel's 29-meter threshold reflects a different calculus. It's pegged to the fire department's ladder limit, not to the worst-case scenario.
Which means an Israeli building at 8 stories sits in a kind of regulatory blind spot. The ladder can reach it, so the code says sprinklers are optional. But an 8-story building still has a stairwell. still has a stack effect, still has residents who might be asleep when a fire starts on the ground floor.
That's where the international variation gets revealing. Japan says sprinklers at 6 stories. Germany says 22 meters. The US NFPA standard says all new high-rise residential, period. There is no scientific consensus on the exact height where a building flips from acceptably risky to unacceptably risky. It's a judgment call, and different countries make it differently based on their own disaster histories. The UK made it aggressively low because Grenfell was a national trauma. Israel made it at the latter limit because the Ben Yehuda street fire was 7 stories, and the lesson drawn was about firefighter access, not just resident safety.
The code is not a pure engineering document. It's a political document, written in the aftermath of grief.
And that's why the retrofit question is so hard. If the threshold is a policy choice rather than a physical law, it's harder to argue that every building above it is a death trap. The 8-story building without sprinklers isn't automatically unsafe. It depends on construction material, stairwell design, whether the stairwell doors are fire-rated and self-closing. A concrete building with enclosed stairwells is a very different risk profile from a wood frame building with open stairwells. But the code has to draw a bright line somewhere, and wherever you draw it, the buildings just below it are going to feel arbitrary.
The buildings above it that were built before the line existed are just grandfathered into a lower standard indefinitely.
Which is where we are now. Thousands of buildings in Israel, 10 stories and up, built before 2015, no sprinklers, no legal requirement to add them. And the residents may not even know they're in a higher risk category.
We've got thousands of buildings sitting above the ladder limit with no sprinklers, and the people inside them may not even know. What actually makes one of those buildings considerably more dangerous than another?
It's not just height. The risk is a function of 4 things working together. Construction material, concrete versus wood frame. Stairwell design, is it enclosed with fire-rated doors, or is it open? And occupant mobility. Elderly residents, families with small children, people who can't take the stairs quickly. A 4-story concrete building with enclosed stairwells is dramatically safer than a 12-story building with open stairwells, even if neither has sprinklers. The concrete doesn't burn, the enclosed stairwell keeps smoke out of your evacuation path, and 4 stories is a quick exit. Flip those variables and you've got a problem.
The danger threshold isn't a single number, it's a profile.
And that's part of why the retrofit debate gets stuck. If you say every building over 10 stories needs sprinklers, someone points to a 12-story concrete building with enclosed stairwells and says, look, this one's fine. And they might be right, until a stairwell door gets propped open during a renovation, or a resident stores a gas canister on their balcony, or any of a dozen things that turn a safe enough building into a dangerous one overnight. The sprinkler is the one thing that doesn't care about human behavior. It just sits there and activates when the heat hits.
Which brings us back to why retrofits aren't happening. You laid out the cost and the disruption, but there's a third barrier that might be the real killer, the ownership structure.
The Va'ad Bayit. In an Israeli apartment building, every apartment is individually owned, major capital expenses, and a sprinkler retrofit is about as major as it gets, require a majority vote of the owners. You need 51% to say yes to an assessment that could run 50,000 shekels per apartment. And here's the reality, in a lot of these older buildings, a significant portion of the owners don't live there. They're renting the units out. They see a 50,000 shekel bill for a system they'll never personally need, and they vote no.
The residents who do live there, the renters, don't get a vote at all.
They bear the risk, but they have no say in the decision. It's a perfect misalignment of incentives. The people who could die in a fire can't authorize the system that would save them, and the people who can authorize it have already moved to a newer building with sprinklers.
That's a structural failure, not just a regulatory one.
It's why the insurance angle is so interesting. Insurance companies don't care about the Va'ad Bayit dynamics. They just look at the actuarial tables and price the risk. In Israel, property insurance for a building without sprinklers runs 20 to 40% higher. Some insurers are now requiring sprinkler retrofits for buildings over 10 stories as a condition of coverage. If you can't get insured, you can't get a mortgage. If you can't get a mortgage, you can't sell your apartment. Suddenly, that 50,000 shekel assessment looks different when the alternative is an apartment you can't sell.
The market is doing what the Va'ad Bayit can't, forcing a collective decision by making the cost of inaction higher than the cost of action.
It's a slow mechanism, but it's working. I've seen cases in Tel Aviv where buildings that couldn't get a retrofit approved for years suddenly found consensus once the insurance renewal came in at double the previous premium. The invisible hand wears a fire helmet.
Internationally, different countries have taken very different approaches. You mentioned Japan at 6 stories, Germany at 22 meters. The spread is striking.
Japan is the most conservative. Sprinklers required in all new residential buildings over 6 stories, about 20 meters. That's well below the ladder limit. Germany draws the line at 22 meters. The United States varies by state, but the national standard requires sprinklers in all new high-rise residential. The European Union's Construction Products Regulation sets performance standards, but leaves specific height thresholds to individual member states. So you get this patchwork.
Which tells you there's no scientific consensus on the exact number. If there were a clear engineering answer, every country would land on the same threshold.
That's the insight. The variation proves the threshold is a policy choice, not a physical constant. Japan drew the line low because they have a dense urban population, frequent earthquakes that can damage fire suppression infrastructure, and a cultural memory of devastating urban fires. The 1923 Great Kanto earthquake produced firestorms that killed over 100,000 people. Germany's 22 meters is a more moderate bet. Israel's 29 meters is pegged to the latter, which is a firefighter-centric approach. The UK's 11 meters after Grenfell is trauma-driven. Every number has a story behind it, and none of them are wrong in a strictly scientific sense. They're just different answers to the same question. How much risk are we willing to grandfather into the existing building stock?
The grandfathering is the quiet scandal in all of this. We mandate sprinklers for new buildings, but we let the old ones slide indefinitely. The people in the new towers get protection. The people in the older buildings get a higher insurance bill and a hope that nothing goes wrong.
What do you actually do if you're listening to this and realizing you live in one of those buildings? 10 stories or more, no sprinklers, built before 2015. You're in the highest risk category, and most residents don't even know it.
The first step is embarrassingly simple. Check if your building even has a fire safety certificate. In Israel, it's called a Teyudat Berashut Esh. The building is supposed to have one, and it's supposed to be current. If the building is over 29 meters and has no sprinklers, it's technically non-compliant with the code for new builds. Existing buildings are grandfathered, so it's not illegal, but it tells you where you stand.
Once you know, the next step is to stop being a collection of individual apartment owners and start being a building. Form a fire safety committee, 3 or 4 residents who agree to push the issue. Get a cost estimate for a retrofit. The numbers are real, 1.5 to 3 million shekels for a 10-story building. But you can't have a conversation about it until you have an actual quote from an actual contractor.
This is where the insurance argument becomes your best tool. If property insurance for buildings without sprinklers runs 20 to 40% higher, you can do the math for your specific building. A 30% premium reduction over 5 to 7 years can offset a significant chunk of the retrofit cost. That's the argument that moves the owners who don't live there. It's not about safety for them. It's about the monthly expense they're already paying.
There's also something most Israeli residents have never heard of. The Ministry of Housing runs a program called TAMA 38/2, the National Outline Plan for Strengthening Existing Buildings Against Earthquakes. But it also includes partial subsidies for fire safety retrofits. You can get government money to help pay for sprinklers in an older building. Uptake is low because almost nobody knows the program exists.
The money is sitting there, allocated, and the buildings that need it aren't applying because the residents never thought to check.
That's the information asymmetry. The government doesn't advertise it well, the Va'ad Bayit doesn't know to look for it, and the fire department isn't in the business of knocking on doors to say, by the way, there's a subsidy. If you're in one of these buildings, you have to be the one who finds it.
The broader point here is that fire safety in a multi-unit building is the definition of a collective action problem. Your individual fire extinguisher under the sink is fine. Your smoke detector is necessary, but they protect you, not the building. If the apartment 3 floors below you catches fire at 3 in the morning, your extinguisher does nothing. Your alarm might not even go off until the smoke is already in the stairwell. The sprinkler is the only system that buys time for everyone simultaneously. It hits the fire at the source, right when it starts, before it reaches the hallway. 5 to 10 extra minutes to evacuate. That's the difference between a fire the news never covers and one that gets a street name attached to it.
5 to 10 minutes is the entire margin. In a building with enclosed stairwells and functioning fire doors, that's enough time for most residents to get out. Without sprinklers, the fire reaches the stairwell in 2 or 3 minutes, and after that, the stairwell is a chimney. You can't go down, the ladder can't reach you, and you're waiting for a helicopter that may or may not arrive in time.
The sprinkler isn't really a fire extinguisher in the way people think. It's a time-buying device. It doesn't necessarily put the fire out completely. It suppresses it enough to keep the stairwell clear and the smoke contained until people are out. That's the thing worth explaining to a skeptical neighbor at the Vaad Baib meeting. You're not buying a plumbing project, you're buying 5 minutes.
Which raises the question of whether 5 minutes is even the right target as buildings keep climbing. Israel now has residential towers over 80 stories. At that height, a stairwell evacuation can take 20 minutes or more for someone on the top floors. Sprinklers alone might not be enough. You need compartmentalization, fire-resistant floors, and walls that contain the fire to a single unit even if the sprinklers are overwhelmed.
The Burj Khalifa approach. Sprinklers plus pressurized stairwells that keep smoke out even if a door opens.
Pressurized stairwells create positive pressure so smoke can't enter. Combine that with sprinklers and true compartmentalization. Fire-rated barriers between every unit, and you've got a system where a fire in apartment 14B stays in apartment 14B. The building doesn't evacuate all at once. The people on other floors might not even need to leave. That's the direction the engineering is heading, and it's a fundamentally different philosophy from the sprinkler as time buyer model we've been describing.
The next step past that is smart buildings, real-time fire monitoring, sensors in every unit feeding data to a central system that can route people away from danger instead of just toward the nearest stairwell.
Automated evacuation routing. The building knows where the fire is, knows which stairwells are compromised, and lights up the safe path floor by floor. It's being tested in a few ultra-high-end towers in Dubai and Singapore. Not cheap, not standard, but it's where the logic leads. If you can't evacuate 80 stories in 5 minutes, you stop trying to evacuate the whole building and start managing the fire and the people as two separate problems.
The sprinkler on your ceiling, the one Daniel's been spotting in all the new buildings, is really a transitional technology. It's what we figured out in the late 20th century, and it works, but it's not the final answer for the buildings we're putting up now.
It's a physical reminder that we learned from other people's deaths. Every code change, every glass bulb on every ceiling is written in disaster. Grenfell, Ben Yehuda Street, the MGM Grand, the station, each one left a mark on the rulebook. The sprinkler is the scar tissue.
The question Daniel's really left us with is whether we wait for the next scar to retrofit the buildings we already have. The technology exists. The subsidy programs exist. The insurance math works. What's missing isn't engineering or money. It's the collective will to act before the fire rather than after.
That's the thing about fire safety regulation. It's never proactive. It's always retrospective. The code gets written after the funerals. The retrofit question is whether we can break that pattern just once and fix the buildings we know are vulnerable before a street name gets added to the list.
If you found this interesting, rate and review the show. It helps other people find us.
This has been My Weird Prompts. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. We'll be back next time. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
Slovene is one of the few languages with a grammatical dual number, a special verb form for exactly two people or things, which means that in the 1960s, Slovene-speaking engineers working on Soviet-era infrastructure projects in Turkmenistan had to navigate a language where "we two are building this pipeline" is grammatically distinct from "we three or more are building this pipeline," creating a linguistic precision that Russian, the project's official language, completely lacked.
That's a level of grammatical specificity I was not prepared for.
Turkmenistan pipeline politics and dual number verbs.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird promise, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.